Hello and welcome to the Local Economic Development Podcast.
Hosted by Sean Cunningham
and Jörg Meyer-Starmer.
For other programs in this series, please take a look at www.ledcast.net.
In this episode, I'm going to have a conversation with Lisbeth Navas-Alemann, who is a researcher at the Institute for Development Studies at the University of Sussex. Hi, Lisbeth.
Hi, Jörg.
Why don't you just briefly present yourself and explain what you're doing?
Yes, well, I've been doing research and consultancy on issues of value chain development and also cluster development for some 10 years now. Okay. And I come originally from Venezuela, so I'm very interested in, you know, developing country issues. Okay. And my main research was carried out in Brazil, in the Brazilian footwear and furniture industries.
All right. Okay. Well, maybe let's start by looking at, well, what is going on in the academic discussion on value chains. The academic perception, the academic discussion on value chains has very much looked at global value chains, hasn't it?
Yes. Yes, absolutely. There is an implicit perception that exporting or basically any sort of connection with markets from the north, it's a superior way of learning, it's a superior way of producing.
Right.
Not very. Sometimes it's not a very critical position, and I think I have tended to see other points of view as well, whether this sort of learning is actually always superior or whether it's superior in some occasions for okay. some time, for some products, okay. but not for others, etc.
We'll get to that in just a second, I think.
Okay.
Maybe let's just briefly explain that about this academic discussion. I tend to recall that it started in the early mid-1990s with research on East Asia. Is that true?
Yes. Actually, the global value chain approach that we use in international development these days, it's a bit of a mixture of several approaches that preceded it. There is the systems of innovation approach of more Scandinavian origins. There is the cluster approach on which several institutions like IDS, where I work, have done a lot of work. There is also the value systems approach developed by Professor Michael Porter at Harvard.
Right.
There are several approaches that gave origin to what we know today as the value chain approach that we use. Also the work from USAID in Washington, you know, with their Gemini project.
Right. Yeah.
So what I'm trying to say is that when Gary Gareffi, for many people, the pioneer in the modern global value chain studies, when he developed this approach, actually he had a lot of previous approaches on which he could build, you know, to develop the modern approach that we use today.
Yeah, right.
And he used to call it actually global commodity chains.
Which was a funny way of putting it, because it was not at all about commodities, but rather very, very specific products.
Precisely. And, it was not long after that there was a meeting in Bellagio in Italy, funded by the Rockefeller Foundation, okay. where he allowed himself to be persuaded, you know, by other academics that, yes, perhaps calling it global value chains was a more practical way of viewing these constructs.
Right.
Yes.
Okay. So the focus initially was very much on garment exports and electronics exports from countries like Taiwan and Korea and mainland China and other emerging countries in the Southeast and East Asian region, wasn't it?
Yes, it was. And what he observed was that when these producers from developing countries in East Asia, when they connected with global buyers in these value chains, mm-hmm. they experimented a vertiginous growth rate,
yeah.
and they also experienced learning right. trajectories that were really outstanding.
Right, okay. And that is then kind of, the paradigm that has influenced the whole discussion, or the hope that is driving so many development agencies when they now like USAID are emphasizing the potential of value chain promotion, isn't it?
Yes, yes. I've been carrying out some research on how development agencies are utilizing the value chain approach mm-hmm. for their poverty alleviation strategies. And some of them have started also to question whether it is always the best strategy okay. to try to connect small or micro enterprises to global markets
yeah.
and with very experienced and powerful global buyers.
Right.
They are starting, some of them are starting to question this paradigm.
Mm-hmm. Which is not entirely surprising because there's always been this strange kind of juxtaposition of perspectives. On the one hand, you have those really competent producers of laptop computers and quality garments in East Asia who are interacting with the leading brands in North America and Europe. And on the other hand, you had this approach where people looked at very poor producers, not the poorest of the poor, but pretty poor producers in middle and low income developing countries and hoped that they could elevate those people to a level of sophistication where they would be able to interact with global buyers. I mean, it always appeared a little bit odd, I think.
Yes, yes, it did. But, you know, we must admit that the stories that we received from the East Asian experiences were, you know, outstanding. I mean, there were cases, you know, where actually very low-tech producers, you know, in very rudimentary firms actually evolved to become large exporters, you know, with their own brands. So, I mean, there were this sort of success stories. But I think we failed to recognize that it was not only a function of connecting to markets.
Right.
There was much more at stake there. There were many other factors that right. influenced these outstanding trajectories. And that, I think, is being sometimes left out in an attempt to simplify the approach, in an attempt to get simple answers.
Okay. I mean, you looked at it from the angle of learning earlier. So maybe let's explore that a little bit further. What are the different types of learning that were involved in those very successful cases of connecting developing country producers with global value chains?
Well, in the original cases from East Asia, actually there were three types of learning that was observable. There was the product upgrading, whereby firms will develop new characteristics, physical characteristics for products, and sometimes even be able to acquire higher prices, to demand higher prices for these products. Mm-hmm. There was also process upgrading, whereby firms would improve the way in which they do things, basically change their layout, introduce new management techniques, total quality programs, etc. And there were also cases of functional upgrading, which we understand as the acquisition of capabilities and skills in activities that the firm did not have before. Mm-hmm. So if the firm, for instance, was very good at manufacturing, we consider that they have upgraded functionally if they also manage to market their products as well,
yeah.
or if they also manage to have their own brand, if they also manage to also produce their own designs, and so on.
Yeah.
So in those original cases, you know, in those outstanding cases, the stories actually depicted trajectories from process upgrading, going into product upgrading, and then going into functional upgrading and even developing their own global brands. Mm. So there was this idea of the benign escalator, you know, changing buyers, you know, changing to more demanding buyers as you went along. But what I found in my research in Brazil was that firms that connected to American and European markets in a very hierarchical manner, this is to say when these global buyers gave the Brazilian producers specific designs, specific blueprints on how to produce their products, and they also supervised very closely that they were being done according to those specifications and no other, then firms, they didn't develop the functional upgrading capabilities, but they developed product and process upgrading capabilities very quickly with the assistance of those global buyers. On the other hand, when these producers, not necessarily the same producers, but different producers, that they were focusing more on regional markets, regional meaning other Latin American markets or even domestic markets, the domestic Brazilian market, I noticed that they actually developed very good functional skills such as branding and marketing.
So basically what happens in a situation like that is that, say, a footwear producer or a garment producer, a furniture producer in Brazil is discovered by some global buyer, and they notice that those guys have reasonably good production capabilities, come up with reasonably good quality products at a competitive price.
Yes.
Is it right to assume that the buyer would say, okay, you don't worry about marketing, you don't worry about advertising, commercialization, all those things. We take care of that. You just concentrate on producing a quality product at a competitive price?
Yes, exactly. That's what happened. They were discovered by these buyers.
Okay.
And, of course, we have to understand that in highly unstable economies, like the Brazilian economy at that time in the 70s and 80s, the promise of a stream of foreign exchange was very, very attractive.
Sure.
So that also, you know, we don't have to say that, of course, these producers, they were not being rational. They were being very rational in their choices.
Yeah.
However, there were some other producers that did not make the choice of completely abandoning their branding and design capabilities, even though they were taking advantage of the offer of a foreign exchange stream by global buyers.
Okay.
I call those firms multi-chain firms because they always kept their options open in multiple value chains.
All right.
And they, for instance, they had a percentage of their output going to these global buyers in these hierarchical conditions, not attempting to put their own brand or their own design. But at the same time, they kept their other value chains to the domestic market, to regional markets, where they actually put their own brands, they practice their marketing skills, and they had basically the control of their own supply chain.
Yeah.
And those firms, over time, in my research, they proved to be significantly more successful and competitive than the ones that concentrated on global value chains, especially to the US and Europe. So that's interesting.
Which sounds, well, perfectly plausible. And the question then would be, was it just the sharpness of the business owner, the intelligence of the business owner to decide, hang on, I'm not going to make myself dependent on just one foreign buyer? Or were there other factors that also influenced the behavior and the decisions of business owners?
Yes, as usual, it's a very complex answer, and the nature of entrepreneurship is, of course, very complex and varied.
Yeah.
There were cases of manufacturers where basically it was the pride of having their own brand and having their own distribution channels that kept them from giving them up.
Yeah.
Those were some cases. There were other cases where previous experience with global buyers, especially when they decided to switch to other producers and leave them, you know, basically abandoned, as they will say when I was interviewing them.
Yeah.
So those that had experienced this kind of situation, they learned and they didn't want to be dependent again.
Right.
And yes, basically there were others that they were more strategic in a way. They had a plan. They had a strategic plan for their firm, for the future. So there was a huge mix. Oh, and of course there were some that they didn't know that being not selected by the global firms was a blessing in disguise, because there were some that they were not selected because they were not large enough.
Uh-huh.
or because they didn't have the latest equipment and the latest technologies.
Yeah.
And they felt even humiliated at the time for not being selected, but that forced them to develop their other skills, their functional skills for other markets. So a huge mix of reasons why.
Now, when you look at the more recent and the current situation, to what extent is interacting with global value chains different from being connected to and interacting with value chains that exist at your national level or within your supranational region?
There are very, very big similarities, because what matters more than the destination, I would say, it's the kind of relationship you have with your buyer and the kind of skills that you are allowed to develop in your relationship with this buyer or not.
Okay.
You may have hierarchical relationships in your domestic market as well.
Yeah.
And I also observed that in Brazil, there were also hierarchical relationships between large domestic buyers and producers from the Brazilian context.
Right.
But they had more exit options. They had more opportunities to go to other buyers.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a more atomized market with more exit options, both for the buyers and for the producers.
Right.
So in a way, it was more dynamic than the few options open for producers trying to export to the U.S. And Europe.
Okay. Now, looking at the current situation, if you were in a development agency and you were interacting, say, with reasonably competent furniture producers, and you had to explore now where to direct them and which what kind of market to focus, where would you take them?
Well, I will tell them, if you want to develop your product capabilities, your product and process capabilities, by all means, try to get in contact with one of these global buyers in the Virginia, in the U.S., for instance, or even some of the buyers that produce out of Indonesia or Thailand. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. But do not produce 100% of your production for these buyers. Always keep another part of your production where you can actually put your own seal, your own capabilities to practice. So basically, it's a matter of combining this type of learning opportunities.
Yeah, okay. I mean, looking at the points that you are making, what seems to come out is a bit of a counterintuitive observation, namely that there is not necessarily a route of upgrading that takes you from local to regional to national to international. But it might actually work the other way around, that you get involved in international, at the international level with global buyers at a relatively early stage of your corporate evolution, your corporate life cycle. And then as you learn with them, you say, hang on, this was now all very nice, but I didn't really make much profit with you. And let me now focus at my domestic market where I can make much more money thanks to the skills that I have acquired now.
Well, yes and no. I take part of your argument, especially when you say thanks to the skills that I have acquired. And yes, thanks to the skills in product and process upgrading that they have acquired, but not thanks to the other skills which they have not acquired, most likely, in these kind of relationships.
Right.
And that came out very dramatically in my research when I interviewed some firms that were devoted to the U.S. and European markets in very hierarchical conditions, and they were not allowed to design, they were not allowed to have their own brands. And when they were, so to speak, abandoned by their global buyer because they decided to source from China, they immediately turned to the domestic market and they made huge investments to try to develop their own brands and their own designs. And they failed. They failed and they lost a lot of money because of the domestic established competition.
Right.
So it's some of them, I've been following up on some of them, and they have managed to establish their own brands. But they did not have the skills to do it. So that's why I say yes and no to your argument, because yes, they will be able to be very competitive on product and process upgrading issues, but it's not a guarantee that they are going to manage to have their own identity and actually break into the domestic market just because they have those.
Right, okay.
You know, those they will have to develop in other chains,
yeah.
Either the domestic or regional markets.
Uh-huh.
But if they don't have them, they will fail.
Yeah, okay. I mean, looking at this story from that angle then could also take you to yet another conclusion, and that is that, both researchers and development practitioners have for such a long time been so single-mindedly focused at technological capabilities, productive capabilities,
mm-hmm.
that they have underestimated and underrated the marketing capabilities, the brand development capabilities, the advertising capabilities that a producer also needs to have to be successful in highly competitive markets.
Absolutely. That's part of what I am now studying and in my research.
Okay.
It's basically trying to bring out what is, it, for the innovation studies people, this is called organizational and marketing innovations.
Yeah.
And they have been usually overlooked, as you said, when they are studied in next to the technological capabilities.
Mm-hmm.
But now there is a change. There is a change. There is more interest in this type of capabilities because at the end of the day, without an identity and brand design and image, firms, they are highly dependent. And if that's the route that they want to follow, well, at least they have to do it, you know, in a very conscious way. They have to know that they are in a business-to-business market, for instance, where they don't want to develop a very strong brand, you know, for the consumer market.
Yeah.
But they have to be conscious about it.
Right.
Otherwise, if they don't make very conscious and very purposeful efforts into developing these marketing innovations, they are not going to be a match for other companies who do the same.
Yeah, right. Okay, so in any case, one interesting conclusion then would be to say, well, however you look at the value chain discussion, be it in an academic way or be it from a practitioner's angle, the fact that you really need to look at markets and the way producers are connected to markets is absolutely paramount. And the whole conversation, the whole narrative that is evolving around value chains highlights that point very much.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. The people in firms, you know, they don't face a faceless, chaotic market. Markets
right.
are actually quite well organized
yeah.
in value chains. One could say that most markets where developing country firms are going to export their products, they are highly organized
right.
and they have to be very aware of these relationships and organization.
Okay, maybe let's leave it at that for now.
Mm-hmm.
Thanks a lot for your time, Lisbeth.
Okay, my pleasure. It's always good to think about these issues.
Okay, great. Thanks a lot.
Bye.